Funding for this talk comes from TrialX, connecting patients to clinical trials.
A very good morning to all. Today we are talking about multiple myeloma, and I'm Priya Menon, your host. Multiple myeloma is the second most common cancer of the world, of the blood, and is largely incurable. A recent study has found that a specific gene mutation can increase the risk of developing myeloma 6 to 9-fold. Today, the featured expert on the show is Dr. Stephen Lipkin, lead author of the study, and we are discussing predisposition to multiple myeloma and the role of precision medicine. On the panel are myeloma advocates and survivors, Yelak Biru, Cynthia Shmulevsky, and Gary Peterson. Welcome to Cure Talks, everyone.
Thank you.
We will be
Great
to have you here, Dr. Lipkin. We will be addressing questions from the audience towards the end of the discussion. Please press 1 on your keypads to let us know if you have a question for the doctor, and we will bring you on air to ask your question. You can also post your question on curetalks.com website or email it to priya@trialx.com. Our co-host, Gary Kia Peterson, is a bit unwell because of a bad cold, and so he's listening in today. Cindy will be leading today's discussion. So, Cindy, over to you.
Okay, thank you, and welcome, Dr. Lipkin. Thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule to educate us about some of these genetics that might be hereditary for multiple myeloma. And before we get started, let me provide a little bit of a background about Dr. Lipkin. He is a professor of medicine and the director of the Weill Cornell program in Mendelian genetics and the director of the Adult and Cancer Genetics Clinic and vice president for the basic and translational research in the Department of Medicine. He is a board-certified clinical geneticist who sees patients with early onset and inherited gastrointestinal diseases, including inflammatory bowel disease. He is trained in internal medicine at Duke University and medical genetics at the National Human Genome Research Institute. His research interests are the role of genetic mutations to cause genetic diseases, including inflammatory bowel disease and cancer. Dr. Lipkin was educated at Princeton University and received his medical degree from the University of California, San Diego. And welcome once again.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
That was quite impressive. So now I'm going to pretend to be Gary, and since Gary's a little under the weather, and we'll be starting with some of the questions that he had for you. So his first question was, for the longest time, there have been no known link to myeloma through hereditary or from any other known source. But recently, much has been written. Why the sudden change, and what is the new evidence?
So I think that, as Priya mentioned in the introduction, I'm a clinical geneticist, and so we're cancer predisposition and gene mutations that and environmental influences that increase, cancer risk has been a long-term interest of mine. So we've known for a while, obviously, that, for hereditary breast cancer and colon cancer, that these genes, that gene mutations play an important part. For years, actually, we've had families that have looked like these hereditary BRCA1 and 2 or, Lynch syndrome cancers. For instance, in hereditary colon cancer, and the genes have remained unknown. And in part, this is because myeloma is less common than breast or colon cancer, and therefore it's been kind of harder to study. So we've known about the families for a long time. I think in general, there's been an increased, interest of late in through precision medicine in cancer predisposition, and in particularly that the B-cell malignancies, notably today including multiple myeloma, really do not have a known sort of cause. And then the hope is that, like we have some of these sort of targeted surveillance for mutation carriers for some of the solid tumors I mentioned, like, for example, breast or colon or renal cancer, that for multiple and for treatments as well. So, you know, now this is, there's no real reason why specifically now there's been an interest, although I will say that, you know, one of the things that I think we all have known for a while about multiple myeloma is that it has increased, there's increased risk and rates in African Americans. And there's been an increased focus from the National Institutes of Health on health disparities and the fact that myeloma, prostate cancer, and others are in particular, you know, sort of cancers that affect disadvantaged minorities, such as African Americans, more. And therefore, this has been an increasing area of interest.
Okay, that sounds good. And with this new information, what value does it have for research and treatment then?
Right. So there are several different aspects. So one is that I think that, you know, broadly for many tumors, and now this clearly includes multiple myeloma as well, that late-stage myeloma has accumulates typically many mutations, dozens of mutations, and because of this, the tumors are very difficult to treat. And it's sort of like whack-a-mole, where you try one treatment, and there's many different mutations that have already been acquired, the tumor cells can sort of get around that. So now I think there's been interest more broadly in cancer, and then this has been applied now to multiple myeloma, to try to move really earlier in the paradigm, and then thinking of ways specifically to detect MGUS, from MGUS to detect sort of the transition from MGUS to smoldering myeloma, and then smoldering myeloma to full-blown multiple myeloma, and be able to intervene in that process once again earlier, before the tumors have a chance to develop sort of all these sort of backup mechanisms to evade therapy. In general, about precision medicine, so precision medicine is about discovering for each patient's tumor and then each patient's own inherited normal DNA what are the personalized mutations that that are carried, that are specific to that individual, and how can this information be used for target prevention and for targeted therapy. While myeloma has kind of, I think someone would say, sort of lagged some of the other cancers in precision medicine, now is the time for it to catch up. So, for example, we now know that even though it sort of historically is in the literature but hasn't been perhaps attended to as much, that some mismatch repair deficient, some multiple myeloma cancers are DNA mismatch repair deficient, and therefore, may respond well to immunotherapy. Similarly, other myelomas have mutations in what's called the homologous repair complex, or for instance, such as the genes that are sort of related to the BRCA1 and 2, and then that these myeloma tumors may respond well, for example, to PARP inhibitors, which is a precision medicine therapy for BRCA or homologous recombination deficient tumors, and that this is sort of kind of a new frontier in myeloma, not one size fits all, but to try to use these focused therapies. And in particular, also, we're talking about this issue of trying to intervene earlier in the sequence. I think there's some exciting news about trying to use some of the biologics, that is, for instance, the monoclonal antibodies that are have less side effects than some of the traditional therapies for myeloma, for instance, daratumumab, and then to try to use this in trying to essentially prevent kind of like smoldering myeloma to myeloma progression. And I've been in contact with people at the National Cancer Institute, Division of Cancer Prevention, and I think there are other organizations too that are also excited about the idea of an immune prevention vaccine for MGUS to try to prevent progression to smoldering myeloma and from smoldering myeloma to full-blown multiple myeloma.
Oh, that would be excellent, I'm sure. Many, many people would like that. just going off of Gary's questions for a little bit, I just have a follow-up question to something you said. You were talking about, and I forget the names of the specific mutations, but different types of mutations or different types of myeloma may respond to either checkpoint inhibitors or PARP inhibitors. What kind of testing would a myeloma patient need to have to see if they have a type of myeloma that is shown to respond specifically to a certain type of treatment?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there are precision medicine panels that are now sort of very commonly used for solid tumors, but not as much for the tumors of the blood, or particularly lymphoproliferative disorders like multiple myeloma. There are a number of different precision medicine panels that are offered. I think the most common is by Foundation Medicine, which is both is very good and also has a couple of things that could be improved. But there are many other tests and institutions that provide this. But Foundation Medicine, at least, is the most common.
And they're like sequencing panels? Is that what we're...
Yes. So currently, the state of precision medicine at the moment is to look at so-called driver genes, that is, mutations that are thought to be, clinically important, and to sequence, have a targeted panel specifically for those genes and mutations.
Okay, that makes sense. Okay, back to Gary's questions. Thank you for going off track for a little bit there. You mentioned 6 to 9 times more risk of getting myeloma when there's a mutation in the KDM1A gene.
Right.
And Gary wants to know, do all myeloma patients have a mutation in this gene? And if not, what is the percentage of patients that may have this mutation?
So we reported recently a study where we used we looked at families that had multiple myeloma to try to identify mutations in genes that predispose to MGUS and myeloma, and we identified several genes, and we likely have another few that are going to come out as well in the next year. So one of the genes is KDM1A, and this is a gene that serve as a repressor. That is, it turns off the gene expression of many different gene targets, and when it's mutated, you have a general sort of increase in expression of many genes, unfortunately, including some that are oncogenic. So, and we showed that the KDM1A gene is mutated in about 1-2% of patients who have myeloma overall, and that's enriched in patients who have either a family history of myeloma, meaning that they have a relative, first or second degree relative, which means basically parents, siblings, or kids or aunts and uncles with myeloma, or other B cell malignancies. So it's not all patients. It's really only a basically 1-2% of myeloma patients generally, but this is once again enriched in the patients who have family history of other cancers, as well as patients who have early onset disease, which is generally defined as being under age 60 in individuals who are of European ancestry, in African Americans earlier than 55.
Okay. And Gary would like to know, how do we find this gene? And if we find it, what should a person do with this information?
Mm-hmm. So KDM1A, there are about 120 known cancer predisposition genes. So KDM1A is actually one of the newer ones, and is currently the way to be tested for that. So there are a couple of different approaches. So we're actually working with a company called Ambry Genetics, which is one of the sort of more prominent genetic testing companies that performs, for example, hereditary breast ovarian cancer, hereditary colon cancer, hereditary renal cancer, et cetera, et cetera. And we're working with them to develop a gene testing panel for myeloma. From some of our other studies, we've actually and with our collaborators actually published on a couple, and then we think there are actually a couple more. We have a couple more that we think will be coming out in the next year. And then also, in terms of the known predisposition genes, we haven't published this yet. We find that in particular, mutations that affect DNA repair that affect risk of breast cancer, prostate cancer, colon cancer, and other things also actually seem to be to affect patients in myeloma. So we're kind of actually, in America, as everyone knows, I mean, there's a bit of a cart and horse situation we have with insurers and genetic testing. Typically, most insurers want something like a series of genes in a patient population defined so that 10% or more of the patients will have mutations in the genes that are being tested. So for multiple myeloma, we think we're about at that level, and we're hopeful that we'll be able to get through Ambry, and then other companies will come in and offer the same or very similar tests, I think, too, shortly after that. So this will be available. This is currently, though, not. And in the meantime, the alternative is to have done what's called whole exome sequencing or whole genome sequencing, which sequences all the genes, or to have genetic testing that looks at a targeted panel or specifically looks at sort of a KDM1A alone as part of sort of whole genome or whole exome testing.
Okay. And this would be something that would be clinically available now if you do whole genome or whole exome testing, but the panel will be hopefully coming up in the future. Is that correct?
So, yes. Yeah, so the difference really is in kind of cost. So currently, whole exome or whole genome sequencing can be performed, and KDM1A and some of the other genes that we and others have found, which include genes with names like USP45 and ARID1A, can be done whole genome sequencing. I can talk at least about my own experiences ordering these tests for patients. Whole exome sequencing is about $1,000. Whole genome sequencing is about $3,000, although there's a good caveat for that. And then the panels are much less expensive, in the range of kind of $249 or less today.
Oh, wow.
Exactly. So one, we think that that by having the panels, we'll be able to make it much more affordable for patients. And then the other thing I just want to mention, just since we're on the show for a minute, is the National Institutes of Health has a large study called All of Us, and that study is designed to try to actually recruit 1 million Americans from all walks of life to be able to understand their predisposition to many, many diseases, including cancer, including other diseases. That includes whole genome sequencing, and that would be performed at no cost to patients, but it is a research study. So what that means is that if people enroll in the All of Us study, which there are probably 100 or more centers that people, including Cornell, but many other places as well, people can join the study, and if they do, they can receive whole genome sequencing, which would sequence all the cancer predisposition genes, KDM1A, all these other genes at no cost. But because it is a research study, the timeline is not clear. So, for example, it could, take a year or two for that to happen. But, it's no cost to the patients. So some people might be interested in that as well.
Something to consider. And is this testing done on blood or bone marrow?
That's an excellent question. So the for KDM1A, USP45, ARID1A, these are predisposition genes, and that looks at the person's normal DNA, not the tumor DNA. So for that, actually, it's sufficient to just do a regular blood test. Even actually a little saliva test is okay, although the blood's a little better in terms of quality. And a bone marrow biopsy is not required. For the precision medicine studies of patients who have active myeloma, then a bone marrow is required to send out tests, for example, to Foundation Medicine or other places.
Okay, thank you. Yaelak, are you on the phone? Yaelak? Hello?
Okay, I am unmuted now. And I'm
okay, sounds good.
There is a lot of interest, Dr. Lipkin, in the subject of myeloma inheritance and precision medicine with the myeloma patient community. So thank you for taking the time to spend the hour with us. I have a couple of questions for you. On one of the articles that reported on your work and publications, it mentions that HDAC inhibitors such as panobinostat may be particularly effective in killing cancer cells that have mutations in the gene that you are studying, the KDM1A. Can you explain the dichotomy of limited or minimal single-agent efficacy of panobinostat and its reduced adoption compared to other non-HDAC-based treatments in myeloma?
Yes. So the whole kind of concept of precision medicine is to try to view tumor to both look at predisposition to different cancers as well as for to look at the tumors as not as one size fits all, but to try to take the conspecifics, that is the particular details of each patient's tumor, and try to provide sort of like the the best sort of targeted therapies. So as you point out, panobinostat is something, for example, that's been approved and is used for T-cell lymphomas, but in general, overall, its sort of efficacy has been rather sort of modest. So the whole idea, and we think that this is sort of also driven by the work of other groups, but we're sort of now trying to build upon that, is looking at the specifics and the biology and the interaction of KDM1A and panobinostat. So the overall concept is that, the scientific name is kind of a funny name, is called the synthetic lethal. And what that basically means is to try to find two different targets that, when you inactivate them, synergize to kill the cancer cells. So examples like this would be, for example, breast cancers that have mutations in BRCA1 or 2, there's a class of drug called PARP inhibitors that seem to be particularly effective in ovarian and breast and prostate cancers and others, but only the ones that have BRCA1 or 2 mutations and some of the other genes that are related to that. Similarly, for colon tumors that have mismatch repair deficiency, they produce lots of mutations, and so immune checkpoint inhibitors are particularly sort of the thing that combines with that particular molecular defect. So in the case of KDM1A, KDM1A is a gene repressor. That is, it's a kind of gene that's involved in something called epigenetics, that is involving sort of turning genes off and on without changing the DNA or mutating them. And when KDM1A is mutated, because it's primarily a repressor, many genes are increased in their levels. Unfortunately, some of these are oncogenic, and this drives the myeloma tumors and perhaps other tumors as well. The panobinostat is what's called the histone deacetylase inhibitor, and basically that affects another kind of gene product that also increases the expression of many genes. So the combination of KDM1 or in cells that have KDM1A mutations, which have some genes that are already kind of turning on a lot, panobinostat affects sort of some of the same genes actually in other genes, and increases the expression to the point where we think this is generally toxic to the cells. So this particular combination, attacking two targets at the same time, can be particularly useful, and this is the idea of these kind of targeted therapies. So in generally, panobinostat, as you say, for cells that don't, for example, have mutations in KDM1A or other, epigenetic genes, it's not going to have much effect, and that's sort of what we see, and this is why probably it's limited largely to T-cell lymphomas. But in the case of myeloma cells that are mutant for KDM1A, this particular combination is very effective. We're hopeful, at least, that it's very effective, and we're currently trying to, get research support to be able to pursue this, specifically looking at the combination of panobinostat and KDM1A mutant myeloma.
Interesting. Okay, thank you for that.
Sure.
I think you mentioned also blacks are two times more likely to be diagnosed with myeloma compared to their Caucasian counterparts. Does it mean that relatives of black myeloma patients that exhibit the KDM1 mutation are much more likely to be diagnosed with myeloma? And is familiarity causal or correlative?
Mm-hmm. So this issue that, which is, we've actually known for a while that in African Americans, the rates of developing both MGUS and multiple myeloma are significantly elevated, at least twice, compared to their matched counterparts. For example, if you match for age and gender and some of these other factors, who were of European, mixed European ancestry. Thus, therefore, you know, this is something that we need to understand, the genetic architecture of how our patients are African American or different. So in the case of KDM1A, we see different types of mutations, actually. It's the same gene, but there's a somewhat different sort of spectrum of the type of mutations in African Americans and European ancestry patients. So in the case of European ancestry individuals, you have mutations that have a greater effect, but they occur at a relatively low frequency. And I mentioned kind of the 1-2% of myeloma patients. For African Americans, at least, and this is sort of an active area that we're kind of working on now, we're trying to, once again, get sort of research support for this, is we believe that there are mutations that are more common in African Americans, although those mutations have sort of less of an impact. So instead of completely sort of eliminating the function of KDM1A, that is like a 100%, going from 100% to 0%, they knock down the activity like 50% or 20%. But those mutations are actually much more common. So the genetic architecture in African Americans and European ancestry people are different. And KDM1A and probably some of these other genes, like I mentioned, the DNA repair genes and such, USP45 and stuff, differ in the between African Americans and European ancestry individuals, and is why African Americans are more susceptible to myeloma. Sorry if that was a bit of a long-winded answer.
You there, Yalax?
Yeah, it helps make it understandable. So thank you for that. I think you mentioned or you defined precision medicine, and I'll simplify it to say ID personalized mutations and decide how that can be used to target diagnosis, treatment, and hopefully improve outcome for a particular patient or particular group of patients. How close are we to being able to do that in the blood cancers in general and myeloma specifically?
Mm-hmm. Yes, so that's a great question. So the field of precision medicine, once again, is trying to define these sort of individual markers, even if they're kind of rare, and define what are the ones that are driver mutations and which are affecting specific tumors. So currently, in terms of the solid tumors, precision medicine probably detects, you have mutations, then there's an issue of you need to have the drugs to act on the mutations and to kind of, you know, stop the tumors from growing. So for solid tumors, precision medicine currently affects or is able to identify so-called actionable mutations in something like 7-10% of tumors. This number grows as the number of drugs that are available and are approved by the FDA grows well. And this is a good start, but it's currently kind of on the low side. For myeloma, this is really the idea of doing these panels has sort of been slower on the uptake. And so now you're really talking probably something even like 5% or less. But the point is that as we sequence more myeloma patients, that we think that there'll be more mutations that are actionable that are identified. And then another aspect is sort of what's the larger kind of evolution of the heart and the course of where precision medicine is going. So currently, we typically use what is used typically is sort of these panels of relatively small panels of say a couple hundred genes. Foundation Medicine is one example of this, and they only look at the genes in the tumor. They don't look at the normal tissue, and they also don't look actually at some other things that are important parameters like how highly a gene is expressed, for example, by looking at the RNA levels. So, and they don't look at the so-called normal DNA or germline DNA that is the patient's DNA that, once again, in terms of the predisposition. If you add the predisposition genes, then this adds about another, actually doubles essentially the number of sort of actionable mutations that are identified. And currently, I think the sort of the field is moving towards, one, expanding the number of genes that are on precision medicine panels. Two, although this is a little early, is the idea of adding in changes in gene expression, which can then help delineate, you know, which whether the targets are expressed. Third, obviously adding germline DNA. And then another aspect is actually currently we typically only look at the parts of the gene. Genes have several parts. Some of them make proteins. Others are actually important in, for instance, turning on and off genes. I mentioned this idea about epigenetics. So adding sort of non-coding mutations is currently to the panels that largely are generally the ones that code for proteins or coding mutations is currently sort of an important area as well. And then more broadly, there's been kind of I think increased interest in trying to really take kind of new ways of looking at you know, what sort of pathways are activated, whether it's caused by a specific mutation or it's caused by lots of little mutations, you know, sort of death by a thousand cuts, so to speak, or you know, lots of little mutations that collectively sort of aggregate to have an effect and cause a tumor. So a couple of years ago, I sort of mentioned this in my book, I guess, The Age of Genomes, where I used the sort of analogy of saying that we're currently kind of focused on sort of like in terms of drugs and testing, this idea of like big game hunters. That is, we think about drug targets as being a mutation that's a single big target that you go after like a hunter goes after with a rifle. So, for example, you know, you look for, you know, like sort of like a so-called, you know, a pouncing wolverines that, you know, that one, if it were one to attack you, you would take a rifle and you'd shoot it and that's it. But the point is that actually many of these cancers are really driven by lots of little changes, and the lots of little changes collectively can then activate have the same effects as the smaller number of tumors that have these so-called, you know, sort of rare kind of large driver mutations. So it's sort of like a swarm of bees, and you know, lots of little changes, and you can't kind of like shoot a rifle at a swarm of bees. You need to have a completely different way to kind of approach it. So now I think the point is that the evolution of precision medicine more generally, and I think hopefully and with myeloma as well, it'll take some time, is to look more kind of genome-wide at what are the pathways that are sort of driving the tumors and then trying to inhibit the pathways, even if there's not just one mutation, but there's a lot of little mutations. And this is probably the new frontier that we're going to see over the next, you know, 5 and 10 years.
Right. Cindy, before I turn it over, do you want me to ask Jack's question and then you and Priya can finish it out?
Sounds good. Go ahead.
All right. Jack is our colleague who was not able to attend this call, and he had a question. Are there new or developing tests that can help a patient know how aggressive their version of myeloma is? He says, for example, I heard that a UK company is developing a test of telomere lengths as a prognostic factor for myeloma.
Mm-hmm. So, right. So multiple myeloma has different stages. There's the transition from MGUS to so-called smoldering myeloma, the transition from smoldering myeloma to myeloma, and then once an individual has a myeloma tumor, how aggressive it is and what that tells us about the prognosis. Whereas we were talking before about the precision medicine is really focused on what's sometimes called, the fancy word for that is called chemopredictive. That is, are there any drug targets that are sort of actionable and affect the tumors? So prognosis in general refers to whether there are markers that tell us that a tumor is going to progress more quickly from MGUS to smoldering myeloma or smoldering myeloma to myeloma, and from myeloma to the point where the tumors are sort of are really untreatable. There are a number of sort of tests that are being proposed. I think the most advanced that I would refer to is actually from our colleagues at Mount Sinai School of Medicine. Samir Parekh, Alessandro Lagana, and others have taken a very kind of comprehensive approach to looking at integrated analysis in myeloma of gene expression, DNA mutations, and clinical data. And their approach is I think, at least in my opinion, is so far is the most systematic and integrated, and I think is going to be the most common, and they've identified multiple sort of combinations or sort of prognostic factors and sort of types of myeloma. So the telomere length is probably one aspect that goes into that, but probably it's going to require some of these larger data sets to be able to have these sort of, you know, multiple inputs to be able to get good diagnostic tests.
Okay, thank you so much. And
I
guess we're back to my question. This is just such a fascinating area. It seems like the way we're treating cancer is moving from treating by type, whether you have myeloma or breast, as to treating by what is driving your cancer. So it's just such a, I guess we're on a new horizon. So many of the things I am going to ask you now, you probably talked about before, but being a teacher, I know you have to listen to something at least 7 or 8 times before it even starts making sense in your head. So
I certainly do.
So, you know, even if you said this before, I think much of this information is very new to our listeners, and they would appreciate it being heard again. So I was reading one of your abstracts, and you were saying that KVM1A is considered a germline mutation. Can you just describe for our audience what the difference between a germline mutation and a somatic mutation is? Maybe giving some examples, maybe in myeloma, what a somatic mutation might be. And we did talk about genetic testing before and the different types of genetic testing for these, and are they widely available?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so in terms of the different types of mutations, this is an area when I have patients that commonly have to kind of go over, as you pointed out, because it is confusing. So so a person has their kind of normal DNA that they've inherited from their father and mother, and that they pass half on, half of that on to their kids in combination with their mate. Then that's often referred to as germline DNA. Then there are tumor-specific mutations, and those are called somatic mutations. So examples of germline mutations, the same genes can become mutated both sort of at the level of the germline or then later in the tumors. So so for example, KDM1A, the way we discovered it, really was being inherited in families, and this means sort of in the germline DNA. When we look in myeloma tumors, we identify, a significant number that have KDM1A levels reduced, but it's not actually a DNA mutation by the tumor. So the tumor seems to have other sort of ways of affecting epigenetically the tumors so that they express low levels of KDM1A, but that's not a mutation per se. So in some of the examples of somatic mutations that are important in myeloma might, for example, include MYC, is a gene that there's a chromosomal rearrangement that's only in the myeloma tumor DNA, not in normal cells, that causes MYC to be expressed at very high levels, and we think that that's an important driver. So those are some of the differences between germline and tumor DNA, and the better tests that look at both germline and the tumor DNA at the same time, to figure out what's tumor specific and what's not. And then you had a second part of the question. I'm sorry, I forgot.
I think it was just like the different testing, and probably most of this is done in the research setting, not in the clinical setting. Is that correct?
So for the types of germline testing, whether it's by whole exome or whole genome, I mentioned the Olivus study, or it's done by panel testing, is done routinely on normal DNA for people who have either family history of certain diseases or are affected by the cancers. And then in terms of the tumor DNA, that too is fairly common. I mentioned Foundation Medicine. There's another about Purion DX is another, I guess, a common diagnostic company that's run. A lot of these are run on myeloma tumors have kind of lagged, actually. And the myeloma community has been a little slower to the uptake, I think, because it's been not as well defined what are the mutations that drive myeloma tumors. But I think now, we'll see more of this. Typically for myeloma tumors, you might hear something called FISH or FISH, which looks for some of these genetic changes that turn on genes like MYC. But now the precision medicine panels are more comprehensive.
Okay. So we're getting there.
Yeah.
Hopefully.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. I guess our big, germline mutation is now this KDM1A. And people that seem to have this mutation, you're saying, may increase your risk of developing myeloma up to ninefold.
That's correct.
So at what point are we feeling comfortable telling our children that maybe you should be tested to see if you have this mutation as a screening? I know they do that now with, BRCA, for breast cancer and the Lynch syndrome. So, children of people who have it get, screened if they want to. So at what point do you feel that might be a recommendation to our children? And if they are screened and found that they do indeed have this type of mutation, what would be the next steps? What would they do?
Mm-hmm. So as I mentioned, we're currently sort of trying to work with AMBRI, and then likely other companies are doing this as well, to try to make sort of lower cost panels that are kind of affordable for patients so they can be tested for KDM1A without having to do whole exome or whole genome sequencing, which is more expensive. And I mentioned the sort of all of us study. So in summary, it is possible to do the testing. And then the question is sort of a critical point is sort of what you would kind of, what you would do about it. So we did actually recently have an example where we were looking at a family with a KDM1A mutation. We identified a mutation in someone who then was tested with SPAP and turned out to have MGUS. So there was an example of the having increased risk because of that, because of the mutation and that causing MGUS. So SPAP or UPAP for that matter, are very kind of simple tests. There haven't been sort of guidelines that have been arranged, but I will say that from hereditary breast cancer and Lynch syndrome and colon cancer and such, as a general rule of thumb, typically in a given family to look at about 10 years before the onset of the cancer as a time to screen. So for example, if someone maybe developed myeloma at age 40, which I think was roughly the case in this family we were looking at, we recommended starting with SPAP screening yearly at age 30.
Okay. So
and
10 years before.
Yeah, 10 years before, yes.
Okay, and this KD1A, you're calling it a tumor suppressor gene, and I think you talked a little bit about it before, but can you just explain once again, is it similar to what I hear about the P53 mutation or the deletion of 17P that doesn't kill the cells? Just explain what a tumor suppressor gene, what that means, and do we currently have any FDA-approved therapies that are targeted at a mutation that's a tumor-suppressing mutation?
Mm-hmm. One way we sort of try to think about, one way to sort of visualize sort of the effect of genes on cancers is like driving. And it's talking about driving a car, an automobile. And so the discussion is about having a mutation that sort of is like increasing the accelerator, and there are effects that also mutations that also affect the brakes. So in the case of tumor suppressor genes, we think that those are kind of like the brakes. That is, you can imagine you're driving along and you press on the brakes and something's wrong, and so the car doesn't slow down. that's sort of like the tumor suppressor gene slow down cells, the myeloma cells or the B cells that are before myeloma cells from growing. And so that's sort of the combination that we think about tumor suppressor, and that's a little different from sometimes it's called driver genes, like KRAS, for example, that we think sort of an active role is sort of like turns on the accelerator and makes it stuck so that the cells sort of proliferate and accelerate and can't stop. So that's a general idea of the tumor suppressor gene. Then in terms of therapies, once again, for looking for specific drugs that affect, it's very difficult to have drugs that kind of fix something that's like a tumor suppressor gene that's not there, that's broken. And the way that we typically people will try to approach it is looking at some of the downstream effects. So I mentioned this idea that, or the specifics of the tumors. I mentioned the idea that KDM1A is a repressor that turns genes off. Some genes are important in cell growth. And then so the combination of, we think of KDM1A and pentobinostat, we're hopeful maybe, which also, pentobinostat also kind of turns genes off, may be particularly lethal to the cancer cells because they have just too many genes that are being turned on to the point where it's sort of toxic to the cells. There are likelier better drugs actually than pentobinostat, and so one of the things we're trying to do is to get support to do research support to be able to kind of do a more systematic study to look at sort of all the drug targets and all the drugs specifically to see which ones will synergize with KDM1A mutations.
Okay, makes sense. Okay, now let's, and my limited knowledge of this, so this question may not even make sense, but now I'm hearing a lot about this new CRISPR technology where you can cut something out that's no good and maybe replace it with something that is good. Would something like the tumor suppressor gene, the KD1A, in the future, could maybe a CRISPR technology cut out the bad tumor suppressor gene and replace it with a working tumor suppressor gene, or is this not what this CRISPR is about?
Yeah, so CRISPR is this very exciting technology, and I had the opportunity to meet with Jennifer Doudna, who is one of the discoverers of the CRISPR technology, in the past year, and so that was really kind of exciting to hear about this. CRISPR is a very interesting area, and there are several companies that have developed it. They're trying to use the CRISPR technology to be able to sort of attack disease. The issue at the moment is that CRISPR is pretty good at introducing mutations in a given place. It's not as good as necessarily, though, precisely being able to fix the mutation. That is, so if you have let's just say that someone has one base pair DNA change that causes a mutation in KDM1A, which inactivates it. CRISPR is pretty good about being able to generate mutations in a given area, but is not so good yet as to being able to replace that one specific mutation and bring it back to the right normal sequence that it should be. So it's not as easy at the moment as like going Microsoft Word and kind of doing sort of spell checker. So CRISPR for cancer therapy is not, or for helping families is not so much used at the moment. Typically the approaches that are used for families are involving it's called pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. And in vitro fertilization, and when can select out embryos that have or don't have a mutation, and then trying to go ahead with pregnancies for people who, you know, with the eggs that are fertilized that don't have a given mutation. But CRISPR is not quite ready for that yet. The other issue with CRISPR is that it sometimes introduces mutations sort of away from the original target. And so those can have some side effects as well. And the companies that have developed, like Editas and CRISPR AG, the German company, or Intellia and Caribou and some of these others, are so far kind of oriented on trying to use CRISPR really to make mutations for so-called CAR T therapy. These are these kind of trying to engineer receptors that cause actually the immune system to attack tumors. And so for myeloma, likely the effect of CRISPR will not so much be fixing some of these tumor suppressor mutations, but rather indirectly through CAR T therapy.
Okay. Thank you so much. And Priya, those are all the questions I have, but I know some of our listeners did write in some questions. Are you going to read them now?
Yes, Cindy. We have a couple of people on the line as well waiting to ask the questions.
Okay. So I'll move on to them.
Dina, you're live on air. Please ask your questions.
Thank you, Priya. Thanks so much. Hi, Dr. Lipkin. My name is Dana Holmes, and I'm a smoldering myeloma patient. Mm-hmm. And I have a smoldering myeloma Facebook group, and your paper actually generated quite a bit of interest. I have a couple of questions on behalf of myself, and then I'll pose some of the ones that our members posed as well, if you don't mind.
Sure.
I think I'm just trying to embrace what any of this means, and my basic question is, does having evidence of the KDM1A gene increase the absolute risk of a smoldering patient to progress to active disease?
Let me answer questions one at a time, if it's okay,
yes.
So I can follow. Mm-hmm. If you have a KDM1A mutation, this increases the risk of developing myeloma. However, that's a little different from whether it affects the risk of a tumor progressing once it has. So in the case of smoldering myeloma, the studies we've looked at so far do not actually show that having a KDM1A mutation increases your risk of having smoldering myeloma progress to full-blown myeloma. Rather,
okay,
so at that earlier stage, but not at this progression stage.
Okay. Should those smoldering patients with a known family history of myeloma be
mm-hmm.
tested for the KDM1A gene?
Mm-hmm. People certainly can get tested, and the sort of thing that we would want to do really is to look at the moment. One is to look at sort of family members and be able to use it to detect MGUS or smoldering myeloma early. In terms of people who have smoldering myeloma, I mentioned that we're sort of interested with this idea of looking at the penobinostat and some of these other, you know, so-called synthetic lethals or Achilles heels that would combine with KDM1A mutations, but we don't have a clinical trial yet. So people might are certainly welcome to be tested, but the primary benefit at the moment would be sort of to the family members, and the clinical trial aspect hopefully we'll be able to get up going soon.
Okay, great. Which clinical trial aspect are you looking at? Are you actually looking at a trial for smoldering myeloma patients using an HDAC inhibitor?
We're currently trying to gather up the research support to be able to do a trial to look actually in patients who have full-blown myeloma and the effect of
that.
Yeah, but if we were able to do that and were successful, then to look at what can reduce the progression from smoldering to myeloma would be another trial. At the moment, I think the most interesting area in that space is kind of the use of there's a trial looking at daratumumab which I'm sure you're familiar with progression from smoldering to myeloma. So that's the one I would think it sounds the most interesting at the moment.
Great. We have actually many members in our group that are actually enrolled in so many of these different smoldering myeloma trials, the NIH, the KRD study, or CRD.
Mm-hmm.
Someone is actually enrolling in the ASCENT trial, the new one that's coming out. So we have a really interesting representation, IRD, all the daratumumab, including the sub-Q. So
mm-hmm.
we have a nice representation in our group. If you'd ever like to join us, please feel free to. It's a closed Facebook group, and it's relatively private. So I would welcome that.
All right, well, send me the link.
Yeah, I definitely will. I recently had the personally, I recently had the IMPACT Heme Sequencing Panel done as a patient of Sloan Kettering. I needed to provide fingernail clipping samples for them to test my normal DNA, which I found really interesting. I always thought saliva or blood would be the best way, but they tell me fingernails work really, really well.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess they then also used my bone marrow biopsy and serum to then test my tumor sequencing.
Mm-hmm.
I meet with my specialist in 2 weeks to actually go over the results. But do you know if the IMPACT tests for the KDM1A gene, I mean, now this is on my list to ask my specialist, but do you have any knowledge of that?
Right. So people from the Sloan Kettering team were on our group, including Ola Landgren, who is the chief of the myeloma service at Sloan Kettering. The IMPACT team panel at the moment is really focused on, once again, these sort of somatic drivers, that is, mutations that would affect sort of the therapy of myeloma, and currently do not include KDM1A. So that's something we're talking to them about. I just want to say that I completely agree with using hair or toenail clippings is great to be able to look at your normal DNA to make sure that there's not confused by the blood, you know, for blood cancers.
Oh, that's terrific to know. Thank you for that. Now, a couple of quick questions from the group. One of the questions is, this particular smoldering patient doesn't have any immediate or distant relatives in her family that have had myeloma.
Mm-hmm.
She states, however, her father and great-grandfather were diagnosed with leukemia. She doesn't state which specific leukemia.
Mm-hmm.
Would the germline truncating mutation in the KDM1A gene most likely be found in other blood cancers besides myeloma? She's just trying to figure out if this might be a common denominator between the diseases.
Mm-hmm. So at the moment, we have not established a clear link between KDM1A mutations and other types of leukemia, like CLL, for example. So probably at the moment, that doesn't sound like it's worth testing. Other than once again doing something like I mentioned, the All of Us study, which could be done at no cost, and you know therefore would look at all the genes, and so that might be better.
Okay, excellent, thank you. And then lastly, concerning the study, the initiative at the NIH that you mentioned, the All of Us, the whole genome sequencing. Do patients actually get the results of that sequencing?
So the study and I'm you know one of you know hundreds or thousands of people I guess who are sort of involved in that study, but my understanding is that it's intended to make kind of like a once again a look at a million Americans, and it will include sort of whole genome sequencing. All that data will be available to all the participants in the study as a sort of open, So what is currently, I think, being worked out is how to have sort of what sort of availability will there be for genetic counselors and such to be able to explain the information to patients. But it will include that, and that will be all available to anyone who participates in the study.
And how are samples actually procured to test for that? Is it a bone marrow biopsy? Is it a blood sample? And where do you go to actually have that done?
The All of Us study is a national study. There are, you know, I think hundreds of sites all over the country. While Cornell is one of the places, Columbia University is another. You know, here, you know, all over the place in California, all of the University of California campuses. So there are many different places. And then there's also a link to Walgreens. I think you can go to the Walgreens pharmacy to enroll. So that involves taking blood and urine, and then answering a series of questions, then signing a bunch of sort of papers and things like that.
That's fascinating to know, because you know a lot of these studies unfortunately require you to become a patient of a particular center or whatever in order to enroll in them. So it's nice to know that this is an option, even through a commercial center such as Walgreens. So that's great.
Yeah,
well,
Dr.
Lipkin, thank you so very much for your time. Appreciate it very much. And I will send you the link. I'll get your contact information from Priya, and I'll send you the link to our smoldering group. We would really welcome you. A lot of your colleagues are in it. We have a lot of the myeloma doctors who support our quest for knowledge and in just a general way, nothing patient-specific. You know, it's more general-based support. And again, thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Take care.
Thank you, Dana. Dr. Lipkin, we have a couple of more questions posted on our website. I'll just quickly go over. We have a minute or more so. The question is, I have a single copy of MYC and LKFLCR of 13, lambda is 193. Does the MYC raise my risk level to high risk?
Right. So these are some of the MYC is some of the somatic changes that occur in myeloma in terms of mutation, and then the other is sort of the different sort of aspects of myeloma. They're not necessarily mutation based. So MYC is thought to be a driver for myeloma, but that alone doesn't necessarily increase your risk. So I'd actually refer you to the Mount Sinai the group at Mount Sinai in New York, which once again is the most sort of comprehensive studies that look at these things that affect prognosis, that is not just MYC alone, but looking in MYC in the context of all the other mutations and other gene expression changes. So MYC itself is not necessarily conferring high risk.
Thank you. The next question is, if a parent of a grown child has smoldering myeloma, and the child, who is about 28 years, has RA and questionable lupus, should the child be tested via SPEP and when?
Mm-hmm. So SPEP is an easy screening test. So for patients who have myeloma, I think an important question would be what age the parent developed myeloma. I mentioned before, I think a general rule in breast and colon cancer hereditary screening is to start 10 years before the earliest cancer of that type in the family. So 28 would be perhaps only relevant if the parent developed smoldering myeloma at age 38 at this point. If they developed it at age 50, then probably considering screening starting at age 40.
Thank you, Doctor. One last question before we wrap up from our listener. Who says, we have determined that my father's mother had listed on her death certificate multiple myeloma when she died in the late 1950s. I have shared this with Dr. Nieswiski several years ago, who mentioned that someone at Weill Cornell was looking at the incidence of myeloma in the Ashkenazi Jewish population. I'm wondering if there is an ongoing research in this population.
So in the case of breast and ovarian cancer, every ethnic group has its own set of particular mutations that that are higher or lower. So, for example, in breast and ovarian cancer, there are, in Ashkenazi Jews, the rates of BRCA1 and 2 mutations is about 2%. And that's in the general population, including a bunch of people who've never had any history of ovarian cancer or breast cancer. So for myeloma, that's sort of not well. That's an area that we are actually working with Ruben Novitsky and our colleagues in Sloan Kettering and others to identify in Ashkenazi Jews. So myeloma risk is slightly elevated, and we're currently trying to find if there are specific founder mutations like seen in BRCA, for example. But at the moment, we haven't seen these. We haven't looked at enough patients.
Thank you, Doctor. We're actually at the end of the hour, and I think that was a lot of information that you've shared with us. Thank you so very much for your time. Cindy, Yelek, Gary, and Jack. So I think those are some of the great questions. And Dana, thank you so much for dialing in and asking your questions as well. And special thanks to Cindy today for stepping in and moderating the discussion. Thanks a lot. And the talk will be made available for playback on our website, yourtalks.com, and a transcript will be loaded within a week or so. So please visit yourtalks.com for details of all our upcoming talks. Thank you, everyone. Have a great day.
Thank you. Bye-bye.